Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the podcast of Soundcheck. Support for this free service comes from the members of WNYC. During our current fundraising drive, please become a financially involved WNYC member. For a $50 gift, you'll receive a WNYC iPod cover. You can see the iPod cover and all the ways we'd love to say thank you and make an e-pledge at WNYC.org.
Although she's none the wiser, although we barely met, I couldn't recognize her from the treatment that I get. So it's my duty to advise her. If she breaks the rules I've set, I'll quit, though I'll admit that hasn't happened yet. I believe she's lying. I trust to undermine my faith in her in time. I have every confidence that she'll dismantle mine, given time.
This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. Chances are you know John Bryan, even if you don't know his name. He is the composer of scores for such offbeat films as Punch Drunk Love, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and last year's I Heart Huckabees. He is also one of the top producers in music today, working with artists like Fiona Apple, Beck, and Kanye West. And to complete the Renaissance man credentials, John Bryan is also a singer and songwriter whose regular Friday night gigs at the L.A. Club Largo are a Los Angeles institution. Tonight, that institution comes to New York as John Bryan performs two shows at the Canal Room. And he joins us here in our studio today. John Bryan, welcome to Soundcheck.
Howdy.
So this song that we were just listening to, this is from your one solo record to date. Mm-hmm. The album is called Meaningless. And it's on the straight-to-cut-out record label.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
What are you trying to tell us about
well,
your music
it's,
here?
Well, it's less a self-defeatist thing. It was at one point when I was on a major label, I handed in... my girlfriend at the time was painting pictures with a friend where they'd both paint at the same time. And she had one of the Statue of Liberty, which... I thought it was kind of cool because it comes up in the lyrics of the song Meaningless. So I suggested I just have a picture of myself in front of this thing because I thought it was a really cool image and would relate to the record in a neat way. And I just had her take a snapshot and sent it into the record company and said, you know, this isn't the real cover. This is just sort of the idea. I've got a couple of friends who are good photographers and I think it would make a nice image. And I got the message back and said, well, you know what, this cover says to me, like, what? Straight to cut out.
For folks who don't know the literal meaning of cut out is when...
Back when we used to have vinyl.
When you had vinyl, they'd put a little notch in the corner of the album cover.
So meaning, they couldn't resell it.
Right. And those would often go into a special bin where you could buy like five for a dollar or something.
Yeah, well, they were usually meant, well, for folks such as yourself, for radio people or for promotional reason. And it was supposed to be a legal way of keeping people from reselling the record at Walmart. But of mm-hmm. course, as we all know, every major city had a used record shop. And, you know, when I was 15, and, you know, and this kind of cuts right into the whole downloading thing going on now, you know, passionate music lover, and I spent all my money on records and, you know,
absolutely.
Instruments when I was yeah. a kid. That's all I did and still is kind of the truth. But I wanted to get as much music as I could. So you'd go in these places and it would be 99 cents for a current record. And that's what you do. You'd get five of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd buy, you know, new records when you could. And in truth, that's how we built up being interested in records and wanting to have lots of them.
Right.
And in truth, now I'm somebody who can't walk into a record store without spending a great deal of money. So I think...
So I think
in a way we shouldn't worry about downloads. I think it's like, you know, the drug dealer going up to the schoolyard and going, first one's free.
First one's always free. Absolutely, yeah. So downloading seems to be doing the same thing. It gets people jazzed about their favorite artists, and then they can go and buy the stuff. I mean, you remember the inside sleeves of LPs used to have a picture of a cassette with the skull and crossbones?
Oh, God, yes.
yeah. and saying home taping is killing music.
Yeah.
Never happened.
No.
Music's a hard thing to kill.
Yeah. No, it's got its tenacity, and it's going to be around.
Yeah. Now, the music that we were just hearing, this I Believe She's Lying from the album Meaningless, I mean, a lot of the hallmarks of the John Bryan sound, you got the kind of off-kilter arrangement.
If there is such a thing, yeah.
You know, lots of unexpected sounds and things like that. As a singer-songwriter, do you spend more time sort of after having written the lyrics and the chord sequence in sort of fleshing out the arrangement?
Well, as a singer-songwriter, it's just the lyrics I worry about. The music's easy. It usually comes within 10 minutes. Getting lyrics so I believe in them and so they read well to me, that's where all the time is spent. And recording, you know, often the stuff which people think is what's labored over isn't. The odd sounds and whatever is just playfulness, and you do a lot of stuff, and then you edit judiciously.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Well, I guess almost inevitably, you know, since you're based in California, critics often describe your songs as having a kind of sunny California pop sound. I mean,
which is very funny to me.
Yeah, and
I grew up on the East Coast, and you know, I don't know that it's. That my stuff is particularly sunny sounding. I mean, there might be a brightness because it has melody, which I think our associations with melodic music are bright and sunny. Mm. I don't know that what I make actually is. There's stuff that's up-tempo and there's stuff that's melodic, yes.
Right. Well, I mean, the Beach Boys made allegedly sunny, up-tempo California pop, and, you know, there are...
Which was true up to a point. And then,
yeah. So now when people come to your shows in L.A. or, you know, at the Canal Room tonight and or tomorrow night because a show has been added, how much of this can they get? I mean, you can't do all the layering, all the arranging in a live situation.
Well,
or
actually,
can you?
I've actually figured out some ways of doing that. I sort of have a thing where I make records on the spot because of what's available now technologically with, you know, what they call looper boxes. You can do a great deal of overdubbing on the spot. I mean, for instance, the best person who uses looper boxes and has been doing it the longest to the greatest artistic effect is a guy named Joseph Arthur. And if you go see him, he's playing an acoustic guitar, he has a mic to sing into, and then he will absolutely blow your mind, and he's great, and he's a thorough original to see as a performer.
And has played here in this studio just a couple of weeks ago.
I believe it. Right. So he uses them as he uses them. I have this thing where my show is more about kind of getting out of the way of my own subconscious. I have no set list, so if I feel like whatever song occurs to me I play and whatever style my subconscious tells me to play it in, I go with. And so that means on any given night it could be mostly covers, but maybe not played as they were originally done. Or it could be my own stuff done very straight or not. I don't know.
Hmm.
And so in terms of making the complex things, I make sure to have enough things around on stage to keep myself amused. And I've got a bunch of loopers on all of the instruments on stage. So I can essentially, rather than, say, use an instrument to build up a track, you know, I can sort of go through the process of making a record in front of people. It's a little hard to describe on the air. I think it's self-evident if you see it.
And does the audience just kind of sit there and take it all in, or are you putting them to
work? I hope so. You know, we live in hope.
Uh-huh. But you're not putting them to work then?
No, although I've been known to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like singing and stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I've been known to make them, you know, be the percussion section when necessary.
Okay.
So,
when you do covers, what kind of stuff are you generally doing?
See, there's not an easy answer to that. It really is whatever occurs to me.
Okay. Growing up, I mean, was there music in the family?
Yeah, my dad was a band director and my mom was a real
like a marching concert band.
Yeah. And so there was always music in the house, and I was pretty obsessed with it. I mean, since my earliest memories are of playing music. So I've been playing my whole life, and It was less that I was influenced to be a musician by the household than the fact that I gravitated towards music and there was no resistance from the household.
Mm.
I mean, that's the real difference between myself and most of my friends. I mean, most of my friends got the talk of, you know, anything from you better have something to fall back on or this is really cute for a hobby and to you, I forbid you
right.
to do this. That's what most people I know got. I mean, I've had friends who, you know, I had a friend whose, you know, stepdad closed the piano lid on his hands, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm.
So I got the opposite of that. So, which is great.
Yeah. Now, a lot of your friends show up at your shows and many of them are
freeloaders.
So, you know, if Beck or Amy Mann or someone wanders out on stage, that's because they're someone that you've kind of made a connection with, either as a producer or a musician.
We've done something together in the past, and it's a natural thing. And
any of that happening here in New York?
This might sound like an evasive answer, but it's the truth. It's kind of like when you asked what I would play.
Right.
I don't know, and I've set it up so that I don't know when I walk in.
Mm-hmm.
The whole gig is about trusting that you'll come up with the answer on the spot, and I think there's a certain sporting event factor in that for the audience, and in a good way, that if they know you have to come up with it, then they know at the start of each song there's a certain risk, there's a certain danger. When somebody walks out on stage and you don't know what you're going to do, you know, it's sort of like, okay, how are these two going to figure it out? And then as the song's going along, it's like, oh, are they going to remember the lyrics? Everything becomes something that pulls you towards the stage,
right.
I think.
So there's no
even
net.
If it's just the belief, oh, they're really going to mess this one up. That's it's still, it's a positive effect in terms of, well, you know, I like the idea that the audience would be investing themselves more in a show. Because
mm-hmm.
I find myself very distant when I go see most, like two guitar, bass, and drum bands or singer-songwriter on a stool. I find myself checked out after a couple of songs because within one or two songs, they present what their idea of themselves is. And once you've gotten it, if it hasn't gotten your heart or your head, it's like, okay, well, now I know I've got 45 more minutes of this, of them going through this motion of presenting this idea of themselves. And I'm so bored with it, I can't even tell you.
All right, so you're out there with no net,
mm-hmm.
and we're speaking with John Bryan, who will be performing tonight at 8 and 10 at the Canal Room. Details online at canalroomlive.com. A show has been added for tomorrow evening as well at 8 o'clock. There are two major albums out right now that bear your musical thumbprint. There's the early, sort of illegally released edition of the Fiona Apple
mm-hmm.
album. And then there's Kanye West's Late Registration, where you produced 11 of the 16 tracks.
Co-produced with him.
Okay. What did you... I mean, this guy was himself a producer before he became famous as an artist, so...
That was half the reason I wanted to do it. To me, it was like getting a master class with somebody who is at the sort of top of a particular genre, you know, of not just hip-hop, but the idea of this sort of pop, hip-hop. He already was in his own world.
Right.
He's not a cookie-cutter guy. Numerous things fascinated me. A, I liked him already.
Right.
And when he called, it was very matter-of-fact. It was just like, yeah, I was just thinking we should get together. I'm like, okay. And then you think, okay, the guy's making his sophomore record, which is the time where people get conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And he's willing to mess with the formula. That's a very good sign. And once I got together with him, I found him so smart and so conceptually smart. You know, his ability to deal in multiple larger concepts at one time, it speaks of a very pointed intelligence. Very taken with that. And I also just think he's a nice, great guy. Everything made me into it. The fact that he was a very successful producer on his own made it seem like a very cool experiment. So that made it more interesting to me, besides just the left turn of working with him making it interesting. Like everything about the setup just kind of made me, it was like a, it was a very easy, instant yes.
Was this your first time producing a hip-hop act?
Yeah, although I've wanted to for years. He's just the first person to ask.
Okay. So. The song we're going to hear is We Major from the Kanye West record Late Registration, co-produced by my guest, John Bryan.
Better do your job and roll up and watch how we roll up and I can't control it, can't hold it, it's so nuts. I take a sip of that yak, I wanna take a hit of that, it got me stuck. But really what's amazing is how I keep blazing towel under the door, I'm smoking to the days and puff puff and pass the up rotation. Hypnotic for Henny, that that's a chaser. Turn nothing to something, that pippin' that's a savior. Best things like green, that pippin' get your paper. High off the ground instead of skyscraper. Cool out, thinking we local, come on homie, we major.
We major? Come on homie, we major.
We major?
Come on homie, we major.
Kanye West, We Major, from the album Late Registration. John Bryan, what did you do with this? Are you responsible for the kind of swirling keyboards and strings?
No. A friend of Kanye's made this section of the backing track, and I think there's a little snare drum fill in there with my friend Matt Chamberlain. The section that I added to this was... There's a great deal of pipe organ.
Pipe organ?
Yeah, during I Heart Huckabees, I decided I wanted to use Mighty Wurlitzer for a soundtrack because I realized no one ever had. They used all these cheesy samplers in these movies that just sound awful, like replicating orchestra, like bad synth string sounds. And I thought, well, in the 20s, before movies had sound, the reason the Mighty Wurlitzer was developed was... You know, Fox Movie Company would have the Fox Theater in every major city. Mm-hmm. They'd have a Mighty Wurlitzer, and it would have all the instruments up in the rafters. It would play grand pianos and vibraphones and marimbas and have pipe organ stuff. And the phrase, all the bells and whistles, comes from that era. It was considered a good organ if it had all the sound effects.
Right.
So I thought, well, these things were designed to do sound for movies, but as soon as sound came in, they stopped using them and went right to orchestra. So I went and looked for one because I liked the idea of using it for a modern soundtrack. So there was a very nice fellow named John Ledwin in Calabasas, California, and he had built a house around one. And so I used it to record, and I was so fascinated with the instrument. And when working with Kanye, I thought, okay, there is a left turn that you're not going to get on a hip-hop record.
When you say old school, you mean really old school. All right.
So it was that and a bunch of this old 70s keyboard that Stevie Wonder used to use on Songs in the Key of Life, these old Yamaha things.
Right.
And so the reprise on that song is basically just sheets of pipe organ and stuff like that.
John Bryan is my guest. He's performing tonight at the Canal Room and tomorrow night as well. And his new CD is a solo CD. It's called Meaningless. He also produced Late Registration and Fiona Apple's Extraordinary Machine. Mm-hmm. What was your reaction to the leak of the unfinished mixes
with her? I was unhappy for her sake because I feel like, you know, artists should be able to work in private and figure out what they want to present. So, you know, I wasn't too pleased for her. And I do, as much as, you know, we were talking about downloading earlier and being sort of okay with it conceptually in terms of people getting turned on to music.
Mm-hmm.
In my life, I'm not thrilled about the fact that I used to be able to, in truth, do things with friends at my gigs more freely. But right now, anything you ever do publicly, you are a lapel mic away from posterity.
Right, right.
And so you no longer can have a friend who, on a few beers coming up and sort of, you know, go through some covers and not worry about messing up the lyrics and not worry specifically how it sounds. And everybody in the room has a nice communal experience.
Right.
That doesn't exist anymore. You know, I used to have friends come to my gig because they wanted to try out new material in front of an audience that was open-minded. And I discourage people from doing that now because the songs end up on the net.
Somebody's there with some kind of recording device and it gets posted that night.
And I think that's a drag. And I think it's a drag that she should, you know, put out a record and have to deal with comparisons. Nobody should hear anything leading up to what she wanted. I'm also not a fan of a lot of the stuff that leaked as it was all, you know, mixed and remixed after the fact, pretty much beyond recognition of the organic thing it started as. The songs that, at least in that batch of stuff that sound right, are the ones that are just her with, say, an orchestra, because there's not much you can do to mess it up. So I think those at least give an indication of something that was there. Anything else, they are so drastically removed from...
Right. Well, I think, you know, Fiona Apple, when she was here, her feeling was that she would like to actually finish those mixes and let people have
them. Right,
we've
actually talked about that, and I think that's something that'll happen this year.
Okay. So. We're speaking with John Bryan, the producer, singer, songwriter, ex-member of this band, The Grays. We'll continue our conversation with him. Yes, we're plumbing the depths of your sordid musical past. And we'll continue our conversation.
Hey, this is getting like Spinal Tap fast.
With John Bryan on Soundcheck.
Father's not the man that we knew. And you know we get so old. That's when you find me alone with my will and my wine. And
it was happy at the start when you offered me the part.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. My guest is John Bryan, who composed the scores for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. This is from the film I Heart Huckabees, numerous others. Also a singer, songwriter, and top shelf producer these days. Let's talk a little bit about your film scores. I mean, I Heart Huckabees, there were a couple of reviews, at least, that were not so favorable about the movie, but that went out of their way to point to the score as something that kind of wove everything together, in a sense. That's a lot to put on a film score.
Yeah, it's an interesting take on it. I guess my argument would be, if they thought it was woven together, there had to be something there in the first place. So I think they're wrong about the movie.
Mm-hmm.
To even say I'm extremely selective about who I've worked with movie-wise is an understatement. A long time ago, I chose not to be, as I always say, sort of a careerist anything. Mm-hmm. If I was a full-time movie producer, for every movie I like, I'd have to fill my calendar with four I didn't actually have a feeling for. Same with record production, same if I only did my own stuff. And so by having a diverse career, I can be more selective. In other words, I can just produce when it's an artist I believe in. And so, I mean, I really think David O. Russell is one of the great, unique filmmakers. And I feel the same way about Charlie Kaufman and Michel Gondry and obviously Paul Anderson, who I worship and adore, who I think is one of the most singular people in the medium. You know, I had just finished Eternal Sunshine. The last thing on my list was to make another movie right away. And somebody said, well, you know, David O. Russell's making a film. You should go see it. And I adored Flirting with Disaster. Just thought it was just an incredible, funny movie. And when I saw Huckabees, and I'm delighted with that movie, having nothing to do with what I've done, because he deals with all these big, heavy concepts in a lighthearted, conversational way.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a big fan of it and of the points the movie is trying to make.
When you say,
so for me, it was really, that makes the job easy. Mm-hmm. To me, it wasn't like I'm sitting around, how am I going to tie all this silly, pretentious stuff together?
Right.
I mean, to me, it was more just a sort of a delight.
So what did you see? You say you went to see the film. You saw a completed cut?
I saw a completed cut.
Mm-hmm. In other films, Has it been different? Have you seen, like, the daily, the rushes, as they're known, as they're produced each day?
Well, these days you see a semi-completed cut, and while you're working on the music, they're still recutting it, which can be a bit frustrating because you write a piece and then the scene gets recut.
Right.
It's an occupational hazard, and you just put up with it.
Right.
The one case where I really got to very much do it the way I wanted from beginning to end was Punch Drunk Love, where some of the music was written before they were even shooting. And I was going down and visiting the set to figure out what Adam Sandler could play on the harmonium. And once I found out what he was capable of technically, would then write something that would work within the confines of that. And Paul Anderson would stand there, and it would be Emily Watson, Adam, and I sitting around a harmonium in the warehouse set, and him going, no, give me something happier. No, that's too happy. Try something really sad. What is that? What can you do with those notes with that? And we'd go through these possibilities. And the main theme was decided on before shooting began.
Mm-hmm.
And right when he started shooting, he asked me for, he said, could you give me some pieces that have rhythm? Because he said he liked listening to music on headphones when he shot.
This is not Adam now.
This is Paul Anderson.
Paul Anderson.
And he said, I like having some music in my headphones, so when I set up the shots, they have a feeling to them, even if it's not the music I'm going to use. And so I made these two very long percussion pieces. And he absolutely used those on the set to sort of guide him, and then they became the actual pieces in the movie. Because of that, the music in that movie has a symbiosis that, to me, makes me very happy.
Yeah.
But it happened because I didn't go and see the full film at the end, and you're dealing with the director at the end of their process trying to have you fix all their dissatisfactions.
Well, now, this music starting up, this is from I Heart Huckabees. Mm-hmm. This is Monday.
Mm-hmm.
What? I mean, this is a different process from Magnolia. What were you trying to accomplish with this piece of music?
Well, oddly enough, this piece of music was something I had lying around. I did an experiment one day in the studio using the loopers I used live to see what would happen. This song was almost made as a sound check to make sure everything was working.
And it found its way into the movie I Heart Huckabees. Pipe organ you were talking about earlier?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I overdubbed it after the fact, so it had, once again, so there was some symbiosis with the rest of the pieces in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, it seems like you do prefer these kind of offbeat, you know, indie films to the big commercial blockbusters. Is that...
No, it has nothing to do with them being indie or not. And in fact, most of them are the equivalent of what I've done as a record producer. They're probably the small, overlooked films at a major studio that are looked at as indie films because all the indie filmmakers can see the directors are mavericks. And it's the same thing with the people I produce.
Mm-hmm.
They're not indie artists. They are on major labels, but they are not getting the attention of whatever the popular junk of the day is.
Well, but Kanye West certainly is getting his fair share of attention.
Yeah, that's a little different.
Yeah. All right. Well, John, you've got two gigs tonight, so I guess you have yet another sound check to get uptown
exactly.
to. 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock at the Canal Room, and tomorrow evening, again, a second night of shows has been added at 8 p.m. You can get details online at canalroomlive.com. John Bryan and his little looping devices, and maybe the audience will be put to work at some point as well.
I'm sure.
All right. The CD.
At least their patience will be tested.
John, a real pleasure to have you here this afternoon. John Bryan, my guest on Soundcheck. Thanks for listening to today's podcast of Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.